So Russia has responded to attacks on its citizens. Boy, have they ever. This is what you need to see and know about today.
According to the Yale Budget Lab, the administration's tariffs cost families three times as much as they got back.
You're saying one Jewish life mm-hmm. is worth hundreds or thousands of Palestinian lives?
Not million. It's 10 million, okay?
That just sounds racist.
Yes, I know.
He said it. The Sanchez effect starts right now. Let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. What would you do if somebody tried to kill your family while they're at a restaurant, or your children while they're building a sandcastle on a beach? Man, I know what I would do. You probably would do the same thing, right? Now we also know what the Russian military would do. After 3 days of deadly attacks on families, on diners, on beachgoers, on children, Russia struck back last night, bombing military installations that produced the drones and the missiles that were likely used to attack those children and those families, even at the beach. Watch. See, those are the images that you're looking at right there, images of the strikes. Now, those buildings, those are that are being hit are described by Russian intel as transport and logistics facilities for NATO's drone war against Russia. So Russia used long-range weapons to target and hit these compounds that are used to store and distribute the long and medium-range drone parts. They also identified something interesting I'd never heard about before. They targeted what sounds like the motherlode of drone technology that they found through intel, right? It's a... It's called an automated innovation center. There it is right there, where all the drone parts, the robotic systems, and the electronic warfare equipment is stacked and stored and then shipped out as needed to all the different parts of Ukraine to feed Mr. Zelensky's long-range missile attacks that he has been using against Russia for the past 4 months. So that's what's been happening over the last 24 hours in Kyiv. By the way, just like Europe, a smaller and less powerful entity is threatening Russia, because it is. Japan, another comparatively smaller and less powerful entity, is doing the same thing right now to China. In fact, Japan's government has just put out a new defense white paper, a document, which calls for longer range missiles, counterstrike capabilities, and closer ties between its military and the country's private tech companies to possibly use against China. Now, this is not sitting well with China right now, right? China has reacted in the last 24 hours, calling the white paper a document replete with false narratives and exaggerated security risks. Sound familiar? So how far will China go to ensure that Tokyo doesn't rearm itself, right? Remilitarize, as it did when it attacked China and the United States back during World War II, because that's really what this is all about, right? So listen to what this Chinese businessman and government advisor told me when I talked to him. This was back in February. And I asked him, what will China do if Japan continues down this road of rearming itself? Watch what he says.
There are terms for Japan never to constitute another military threat against China. Otherwise, they will be in breach of their unconditional surrender terms, and China, being a victor nation, has the absolute full right to strike at Japan to prevent the rise of Japanese militarism or neo-Japanese fascism. I've declared on many occasions, the moment Japan possesses nuclear weapon will be the moment of the annihilation of Japan as a state, period.
Period. The annihilation, he said, if they go with nukes or develop nukes. Japan, you know, is not the only country that views China as a threat. In the United States, the Trump administration has all but created a red scare regarding China since he's been in office. It's mostly hype, mostly politics, you know. But that is not stopping the usual fearmongers from weaponizing, in this case, educational exchanges. Look at this headline, right? This is the Global Times. It spells out the key question that no one has yet answered. How is limiting or stopping or deporting Chinese international students going to make the United States a safer country? It won't. You know what it will do? It's probably going to make it dumber. Students from China and India and other Asian countries regularly triple, outscore all other students at U.S. universities, I mean, by a wide margin, right? It's so much so that it's almost like a running gag in movies that even Hollywood puts out or memes that you see on social media. But right now, look, America, my country, is an angry place. It's not exactly a place that's fostering a welcoming environment, which is why, as ridiculous as it may sound, suddenly Chinese students are the enemy. They're seen as a national security threat because they go there to attend U.S. universities. Here is what the Global Times says in its editorial about this. I'll read it to you. It says, quote, "How exactly do international students threaten U.S. national security? This report offers zero evidence, this white paper. Student visa policy has become deeply divisive and highly politicized in the United States. Since last year, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, you know, ICE agents, they've arrested foreign students, triggered widespread panic across the United States and international community." You know, as you look at that, it's kind of hard to disagree, right? Especially when students, some of whom who aren't even Chinese, but they look Chinese, or they have parents who are Chinese, are also being attacked and excluded. Listen to this young man's story.
One of my main concerns was that, is the fact that I am Asian American something that actually benefits me or something that actually disadvantages me? My dad ended up joining this fight as well. So my dad and a bunch of other leaders in the Asian American community formed the Asian American Coalition of Education. With that coalition together, they together filed a joint complaint against Harvard University.
Since 2014, we have lots of progress. And I always ask my son and, well, contribute to the community, service for the community.
He's really not even Chinese. Here's another one about this kind of theme, right? That we talked about this yesterday. Remember yesterday we were talking about Israel's finance minister? The guy who said he doesn't want the United States to know this. Guess what? We know now. But it's better to have American soldiers fighting Iran rather than Israeli soldiers fighting Iran. And he inferred that Israel is deploying the United States military in Iran so Israel doesn't have to do the fighting. And so Iran can be weakened. Well, this comment underscored what many Americans are now saying out loud, that Israel has some kind of superiority complex that has involved now them taking advantage of America's benevolence, right? But if you thought that comment was crazy, by the way, that comment went viral. If you thought that comment was bad, wait until you hear the one I'm about to play for you. So this is apparently some guy on the West Bank. He's being asked by a reporter why he feels, and he's representative of the views there, by the way, why he feels Israelis are better than other people, other races, especially, of course, when it comes to Palestinians. Watch what he says.
Now, after they kill one Israeli people, we need to kill all the people in Tel and Sarah, even Jit and Farata. Why? Because we don't want it to happen again.
It sounds like you're saying one Jewish life mm-hmm. is worth hundreds or thousands of Palestinian lives.
Not million. One Jewish life, it's 10 million, okay?
That just sounds racist.
Yes, I know. I know, but this is the truth. Because God chose us, because of this, you are jealous.
Wow, did you hear that? One is worth more than 10 million because that's the way God wants it to be for his chosen people. You know, when I first saw this comment as I was preparing this newscast, this show for us, you know, I thought that More often than not, when people describe Israelis and that Israelis believe that, or that kind of rhetoric that's coming from Israelis, I've always thought, come on, they don't really think like that. They would never say that kind of thing. They don't really believe that kind of thing. And then I hear it for myself, right? And I can't help but think, my God, these people are serious. This is how they really think. It's not like just him, right? I mean, this is a chorus that we hear over and over again. It's scary. I mean, here, listen for yourself one more time. His words.
One Jewish life, it's 10 million, okay?
I want to tell you now about a U.S. congressman. I know this guy because I covered him when he was running for office. I'm going to show him to you here. His name is Raphael Warnock. He's from Georgia. He's a Democrat. Not exactly the type of U.S. politician one would expect to be defending Russia, by the way. But he's kind of defending Russia. I'll tell you how. What he's actually defending is America's right not to have to continue to pay higher prices every time they go buy something, which is what automatically happens, we know, when the United States puts tariffs on goods that are being imported into the United States. That's what tariffs do. So let me tell you what's really going on. Let me explain this to you. Lindsey Graham just died. So in honor of Lindsey Graham, a war hawk who hated Muslims, hated Asians, hated Russians, hated Venezuelans, hated Cubans, hated Africans, and wanted to go to war with all of them all the time, the United States, in honor of Lindsey Graham, the Congress wants President Trump to now impose what Lindsey Graham would have wanted, 100% tariffs on China, Russia, and Iran, and all the countries who do business with China, Russia, and Iran, right? Because this is what Lindsey Graham would have wanted in his death, I guess. This dude, Warnock, the Democrat from Georgia, says that's crazy. So here he is, in fact, in the past, not too long ago, telling the Treasury Secretary, what tariffs do to American families. Listen.
Well, you should talk to the people in Georgia. They will tell you, sir, that whatever tax relief you think you gave them was more than taken up by these tariffs. According to the Yale Budget Lab, the administration's tariffs cost families three times as much as they got back.
Here's the real irony in all of this. While the United States and the West are talking about taxing Russian oil and gas and tariffs on Russian oil and gas and punishing Russia, you know, because it's selling oil to people and they don't want them to be selling oil to anybody like it's their business. But anyway, there is a new report. Amidst all that, there's a new report out that seems to show that Belgium, which is the epicenter, the very heart of the EU, now is getting all of its gas. You ready? Give you one guess. Russia. Look at this headline. Check this out. Yeah, while they hate Russia, they can't live without Russia. Russia is now Belgium's only LNG supplier because of what's going on with the Iran war and the disruptions. This is according to Bloomberg. See it right there. So the very home of the world's loudest and most diminutive Russia phobe, von der Leyen, they can't make it through one day without Russian gas. While they're hating on Russia, criticizing Russia on a daily basis. Bad Russia. Give me your oil. Give me your gas. We need it. I mean, right? You can't make this stuff up. When we come back, we told you yesterday about YouTube taking down my account, right? This is what happens in social media. Well, now Meta has apparently also taken down the video of somebody who is much more important than Rick Sanchez by about 1 million times. The Prime Minister of India, if you can believe that. That's right. Mr. Modi's video was taken down. The Indian government's upset because what he put out was important. It could have stopped people from demonstrating and possibly getting hurt. They're not happy about this. What's going on? We're going to talk about this with our guest, Ambassador Kanwal Sibal, who is India's former foreign secretary. He's going to grace us with his presence when we come back. Do not go away. Joining us now is a renowned diplomat, Ambassador Kanwal Sabal. He is India's former foreign secretary, among other things, because he's been representing his country in many countries in the past. And it's an honor for us to be able to have a conversation. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks for inviting me.
I guess we got to start with this situation that's going on, this brouhaha between India and Meta. How would you describe what's going on? Is it a real case? Is it a real story? Or is the media just kind of going crazy with this thing?
No, it's a real story. And the government of India has taken this very seriously. They summoned Meta chief to India. He has come along with another senior executive. To talk to the government of India, because the government is extremely unhappy that Prime Minister's address to the nation at midnight on a particular day when this agitation in Delhi was going on was not aired by Meta. And the protesters, what they were saying, the agitators, their statements, some of them were absolutely vicious in terms of language used, was being freely propagated, which means that the algorithms have been done in such a way that anything which is anti-government will get amplified, and anything which explains the viewpoint of the government will be suppressed. So 5 hours, they did not air this, which has rankled the government, and they have summoned these people, and they have come. I think today they are there. And apparently, according to the secretary in charge of our IT ministry, Mark Zuckerberg has expressed his regret and said that they will now redo things in such a way that this does not get repeated. That is one issue. The other issue, of course, is child sexual abuse and stuff like that, which is a problem for Europe and for India. So this time we've told them that you are going to lose your safe harbor if you continue not to deal with the issues that we are raising with you. And also in the future, when we raise an issue with you, we don't want you to say bring a court order and stuff like that. This has to be within, they've given some time limit. I don't know what exactly it is, I've forgotten. They've given a time limit in which the objectionable material has to be removed from the platform.
We've had people on the air here at RT today saying that this could have turned dangerous because what he was essentially trying to do was give an explanation to try and quell demonstrations that were going on in the country. And if the people in those demonstrations don't hear from their prime minister, those demonstrations could turn more violent. Is that a good point? Do you agree with that?
Yes, of course. Well, this is true. This is correct. In fact, the whole thing, see, the prime minister announced in his speech that all the youngsters who were guilty of the most abominable language directed against the government and the prime minister himself will not be proceeded against legally.
Yeah.
There'll be no FIRs or police reports filed against them, because he said that, look, at the end of the day, children are children. They can commit mistakes. They should have a chance to make amends, change their thinking. They have to be persuaded. The elders have to deal with this in a manner that the children are brought back into the right path. And if he then forced them to spend their life in courts and in police stations, that's not the way to go about it. But those who actually committed serious criminal offenses by attacking policemen and injuring them, some of them severely, those will be proceeded against. So now this is a very important statement. Then, of course, the Meta people did not relay it. They did not put it on their platforms, because the algorithms have been done in such a way that anything which is anti-government will get aired much more than something which actually explains the government's point of view.
What do you make of these algorithms that they use in social media? I'll give you an example in my case, right? I mean, I have won Emmy Awards, I have won Peabody Awards, journalism awards. I've worked at CNN and NBC. I've interviewed 4 different presidents of the United States and other prime ministers and world leaders. And yet now, simply because I'm based in Moscow, the algorithm says I have to be excluded from YouTube. So they've taken down my name, my brand, my channel. It doesn't seem fair to me. I'm no different a journalist here than I was when I was working in Washington or New York or Miami. But the algorithms say now I'm a bad guy. That doesn't seem fair to me. It's almost like what they're doing in this case, is it not?
Well, I think you're using very mild words, saying it's not fair. I think it's worse than that. I mean, this is contrary to all the values that they talk about and espouse, and they harangue the rest of the world with those values which makes them feel morally and politically superior. This yeah. kind of censoring, this kind of suppression of voices, not allowing the public to get access to different points of view by serious people. Now, you are a serious person. So it's not as if you are a propagandist of any kind. Mm. But look, at the moment I'm in Paris and I see the French TV, my God, you would think that Russia is collapsing. It's finished as a country. It's mm. on its last legs. It's going to break up. And Kiev is successful in every possible way. And then any drone thing that happens anywhere in Europe this time, in Germany, somewhere near Dresden or someplace like that, again, that these are the Russians who are doing this and stuff like that. Now, this kind of brainwashing that is going on, I can understand that you have a kind of an honest debate where a person can hold these views, but then yeah. there is another person who gives a different point of view so that the public can judge where really the truth lies.
Of course.
But it is all one-sided. You don't feel like watching television here, frankly. It's such a come down.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Iran, which is obviously the biggest story in the world, and nobody seems to be able to figure it out, including the President of the United States. Here's what you just wrote, okay? This is your latest post. You say, everything that could go wrong for the United States and Iran appears to have gone wrong. What began as an attempt to force a strategic outcome has instead strengthened Iran's regional position and exposed the limits of American power. This is important to hear what you have to say, because you're such an experienced diplomat. Do you feel like the United States just stepped in it, as we say in the West?
Well, if this was the first time they did it, I would say that it was a mistake. But they've been doing it again and again.
Yeah.
This is the problem. They think that they can get away with it and they don't learn lessons from history. After all, Iraq, look what's happened to Iraq, what's happened to Libya, what's happened to Syria. Mm-hmm. Yugoslavia has been broken up. This hasn't brought about stability, peace in this region, or allowed societies to function properly or bring about growth and prosperity. Nothing of the kind.
Yeah, but this time,
why repeat that mistake time and again?
But this time, Mr. Ambassador, if I can interrupt you, it seems to be like this time, this might be the Mac Daddy of all errors on the part of the United States. Because you're right. We lost the war in Vietnam. We lost Libya. We lost in Iraq. We lost in Afghanistan. And you could go right down the list. But nobody really noticed. Nobody really said, wow, the United States just got its butt kicked, right? This time, that's what all the world is kind of saying, I think. Maybe I'm looking at it from too far. You agree?
Well, actually, it is very surprising that Iran has shown such capacity, such resilience. After all, it has been under sanctions for God knows how many decades.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, despite this, they have been able to develop military capabilities which are absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
They have the kind of military capabilities that most countries in the global south simply don't have. How have they done it? And then their capacity to bear punishment. After all, they have been subject to God knows how many thousands of their targets have been attacked. Their infrastructure has been attacked also. But nevertheless, they are committed to a certain... they have committed to their country and they're willing to bear this punishment. Now, the biggest tool that they have in their hand, which United States did not cater for, and Trump, to my mind, quite surprisingly admitted that Iran will close the Strait of Hormuz, which would mean that this will affect the flow of oil through this region and then will affect global oil prices.
Yes.
Secondly, that he'll actually attack the Gulf countries. Now, both the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf countries have become hostage, because if he starts destroying the energy infrastructure of Saudi Arabia or of UAE or the water desalination plants or whatever else, and they've shown the capacity to do so because they have actually attacked successfully the U.S. bases in the region which were defended. Now, all these other civilian plants, energy or water salination, they're not defended. They're not. So they can be easily targeted. Now, if that happens, these societies in the Gulf will collapse, and it will be a dramatic consequence for this region and for the global economy. So So I just don't know who the advisors of Mr. Trump are, whether he listens to anybody's advice, what his worldview is, what is his sense of geopolitics. I mean, he thought that, you know, he can do a Venezuelan-like operation in Iran and get away with it. And now he has to live with the consequences. And those consequences, maybe in some senses, Iran has become stronger, but this doesn't necessarily mean that tomorrow there's going to be a sort of a better geopolitical situation in this region. It won't be the case.
You know what it is about India in particular from a diplomatic standpoint, and I'm talking to the right guy to be asking this question because you are, you know, supreme among the many diplomats that have come out of India over the hundreds of years. But India always plays the role of the moderate, and India is always able to be opportunistic about all things that happen in the world. And I ask you this because I've seen India do that regarding China, regarding the United States, regarding Europe, and most notably now regarding Russia when it comes to oil, for example, where you're now getting like a third of your crude from Russia where you weren't in the past. And it's because Russian oil is at a premium and it's less expensive. Makes sense, right? It's a business decision. So what I'm wondering is, as I hear you talk about the rise of Iran, what will happen or what might happen in this relationship in the future between Iran and India if indeed Iran comes out the victor in all of this?
Well, from our point of view, we'll have to very delicately balance our ties in this region, because our ties with the Gulf countries, especially with the UAE, are extremely important. We have about 3.7 million expatriates in the UAE and about 9 to 10 million altogether in this region. But Iran is very important in a very different way. Mind you, at one time, Iran was the second biggest supplier of oil to India until the United States forced us with the threat of sanctions to stop buying oil from Iran. Mm. And since we could get oil from Iraq and Saudi Arabia and UAE and there were other sources, so we sort of decided, all right, we have no choice. We'll do it, but we will not be left high and dry because we have all alternative sources of supply. But tomorrow, if there is an agreement in this region, Iran is right close to us. It is natural that we should have an energy ties with Iran, and they can be revived. And because of that, there'll be much more fallout in terms of economic ties. And then, of course, there is a Chabahar port, which links us to Afghanistan and Central Asia, the international North-South trade corridor, which links India to Russia. These are projects which have not gone off the ground because of U.S. Sanctions and Iran's very troubled relationship with the United States. But if tomorrow there is stability, these projects can also take off, and it can benefit. It can benefit Central Asia and benefit Russia, benefit India. And then finally, we need to have a balance between the Shias and Sunnis, frankly. The Gulf countries are Sunnis largely. Iran is Shia. We need to balance our relationship with these two, sectarian bits of the Islamic world so that we are not seen as being close to one or close to the other. Now, you mentioned that India has been opportunistic. I would say not opportunistic. This is part of our philosophy. Right from the time that we decided to be non-aligned during the Cold War, that it didn't serve our interests. To be on one side against the other, what for? If the other side doesn't do any harm to us, why should we be against the other side?
Yeah, right.
It's the same logic today. If we can have good relations with everybody, we would like to have them.
There's only one sticking area where India has been getting a little bit of a blast of late from people around the world. Of course, these are all Johnny-come-latelys because people who never criticized Israel are all of a sudden all over Israel. You know, it only took them a while to get there. But there seems to be a sense that India might be a little too cozy with Israel. How would you respond to that?
Well, we have been cozy with Israel, no doubt. After the Madrid peace accords, we established diplomatic ties with Israel. Mm-hmm. And after that, the Arab countries have never objected. In fact, our relationship with Egypt, with the Gulf countries, including Saudi Arabia, what have you, has blossomed all these years, when they knew very well what our ties with Israel were, even with Iran. We have maintained a certain level of ties. The Iranian presidents have visited India. Our prime minister has visited Iran. Our foreign minister has visited Iran several times. And they know that we have very close relations with Israel. So they have understood that if we have close relations with Israel, the target are not the Palestinians. We were the first non-Arab state to recognize Palestinian as a state, and they opened their embassy in New Delhi, and we continue to support their cause. But there are other reasons why we need close ties with Israel, because they have supplied us certain very critical technologies in the area of counterterrorism. And since we have suffered from terrorism all these years, this is very, very helpful. Plus, there are certain areas, some advanced missile technologies, where they have collaborated with us and established very close ties with people working on these systems in India. So it's a very mutually beneficial relationship, but from our point of view, it does not come at a cost of our relationship either with the Arab world or Iran or whatever else. And I'll come back to the same thing. Why should the Arab world and Iran then tell us, like the United States is telling
right.
us, friendly with Russia? So why should they tell us don't be friendly with Israel?
No, it's consistent. It's consistent with, I mean, if you study India's MO as much as I have tried to, it's consistent with what India's diplomatic policies have long been. I mean, the only thing I would add, though, in this case, though, how do you skirt the issue of the genocide concern that so many people raise? How do you deal with that?
It is a very difficult issue. But if there is anybody responsible for this genocide in terms of support, which is that country? Let me ask you. Mm. And which is that country which has actually given full political, military, security cover to Israel to do what they did?
Are you referring to my country, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, you know, I don't want to say all the time, America, 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 but this is clear.
Yeah.
So rather than focusing on India, if we have a kind of a relationship with Israel, which is not at all of the same dimension. I mean, if the U.S.-Israel dimension was 1,000, our mm-hmm. dimension with Israel is 1. I mean, so why blame us for what Israel has done in Gaza and this and that and that? But to be more serious in answering your question, it is a problem.
Yeah.
There are no voices in India which are feeling awkward about the fact that we have very close ties with Israel, and Israel has dragged us into a situation where we seem to be some way not sufficiently vocal enough in order to condemn Israel for what has been done in Gaza. Our opposition parties are pretty open. They condemn Israel. Government is more careful because they balance the positives and negatives, and they don't feel that they are in any way responsible for this, and the countries which actually ought to be able to wean Israel away from this method of dealing with opposition is the United States of America. And now the United States of America has teamed up with Israel to hit at Iran, creating even a further problem. So therefore, I would say, yes, it's an issue, but we have to see things in proportion.
Yeah, no.
In any case, in diplomacy, it is never that things are always lily white in every way. There are compromises here and there, but there should be compromises which are defensible.
It's a fair answer, and I think that you've met it head on, and I appreciate that. And I think our viewers all over the world watching us right now, millions of people who are listening to your words, and I think that you've walked that balance of this difficult situation very well and expressed yourself very well. What do you think of Mr. Modi? Is he good? Is he a good PM?
I think in the last 10 years of his governance and more, he has brought a great deal of change in India. The economic growth has been sustained. Mm-hmm. Infrastructure has been developed, especially road and railways, a remarkable change there. The IT sector is doing extremely well. Now he has embarked upon a mission to develop critical technologies in India, semiconductors and what have you. A lot of money is going into this. He's giving tax holidays to companies which can come and set up fabrication units in India in these critical areas. So he's looking ahead. I mean, his goal by 2047 is that India should be a developed country. Now, we won't be there in 2047. We won't be there either. But nevertheless, this is what his aspiration is. And he's working towards that. Now the international environment has become much more difficult. At one time, it seemed that it'll be smoother sailing than it is now with the kind of policy that Trump is pursuing. He has wrecked the entire international system, political, security, trade. So how do we navigate? And he has created a lot of tensions in relations with India. And we were depending on the United States as a key partner for modernizing our country, for developing manufacturing in the most advanced sectors, for big-time investments and this and that. Now, that has been interrupted. But let's see. Trump will not be there forever, and hopefully the Americans will find a new president who's a little more reasonable and has better sense of geopolitics. So on the whole, I would say that Modi is doing extremely well, but. Many people in India, the opposition parties, and many almost congenital anti-Indian forces abroad are not happy. They don't want a strong India, because a strong India can't be manipulated. A weak India, or an India that is not sure of itself, which needs to make compromises externally to be able to get the things that I mentioned, that India they like. That India they like. The India they can talk down to, India they can lecture, and whose internal affairs they can interfere with. So this is where the problem is. Unfortunately for us, our internal lobbies and certain external lobbies and think tanks in the media. Now, look, we have some excellent relations with some European countries, including this country where I am currently. But look at their media. It is not at all sympathetic to India.
No, right. And
in the case with Britain. Britain is not at all sympathetic towards India. German media is not sympathetic towards India. Though, mind you, at the political level, India and Germany, India and France, India and the UK, India and the US, US press is very negative about India. At the official level, there is good understanding. There is a feeling that we must move forward together.
You know,
but
it's funny.
They use the media to keep us unbalanced, to make us look towards them, to make a plea, to sort of exploit our weaknesses within our system, because 1.4 billion people with so many ethnic groups and religions and cultures and languages, there's a lot of scope for mischief. There always will be people will be unhappy in a democratic society of 1.4 billion people. So this gives an opportunity for others to interfere in our relations, and they want to do that. But we have to cope with this.
It's funny how this works in America, India-America relations, because on the one hand, from a personal or familial standpoint, right? I'll give you an example, just using myself as an example. I live in Miami, and my doctor, he's an Indian-American. My lawyer, Ravi, he's an Indian-American. So the depth and breadth of the penetration of India and its culture and its people in America is vast, as obviously you well know because you're well-traveled. But yet, the perception of India outside of the people who are from India who live in America is not wide and varied. In fact, too often, it's stereotypical, if anything
else.
Am I right? Is that your perception as well?
You're right. It is unfortunate that we're not able to change that, because, in part, this meta business, control over these platforms, international platforms, and their algorithms and everything else, it's a very powerful tool that's available to the West, the United States of America, to shape narratives. And they play a very, very major role, especially because the youngsters now only want to have access to these platforms. They don't read any serious journals or newspapers or what have you. And their minds can be conditioned. Certain narratives can be promoted. And we don't have the tools. The Chinese have shielded themselves, but a democratic India can't shield itself. Yeah. So we are constantly fighting this battle of changing the narratives. But even if we have a story to sell, who will pick it up? Who will pick it up? The international media are not going to pick it up. These platforms are not going to pick it up.
I will. We will. We'll do it. We'll put it here. That's what we try to do. I mean, and we've got a pretty big audience. No, but you're absolutely right. I get what you're saying. I think it's hard to fight the Hollywoodization of the media in the United States. You know, what they do with movies about India, for example. They make it look like the country's a slum, when it's far, far, far from that. They don't accentuate the economic capabilities of the country, where it's going. And instead, we get that stereotypical, same as Russia, same as China, same as Muslims in the Middle East. And that's the culprit in the end. I think you're absolutely right, Mr. Ambassador. You know, how do we change that? Because that's key to be able to change people's acceptance of the world and other countries.
You know, in 1970s, Mrs. Indira Gandhi was at the head of what we now call the Global South or the non-aligned countries in UNESCO to build a new information order, a new world information order.
Huh.
Because the feeling back then, and this is 5 decades ago, that the narratives about the rest of the world were being controlled by the West. So we need a change in the information system. But it hasn't happened. Yeah. On the contrary, with the development of these platforms, now there is even a bigger grip of the Western media, broadly defined, including social media, on defining global narratives.
I feel like I've just had a long conversation with a friend. We could go on forever, but we'll have to do it another time. Mr. Ambassador Kanwal Sibal, it's such an honor and a pleasure, and you've been so gracious with your time. We thank you for spending such wonderful time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Rick.
All right. Well, that's it for us. You know, it's always a wonderful opportunity to be able to speak to someone who gives you a true measure of a nation, in his case. I mean, this is one of the most respected and diplomats in the world. And to be able to go through the litany of all the questions that need to be asked about, you know, including my conversation with him about his relationship or his country's relationship with Israel, which is really, as they would say there, a sticky wicket issue, right? And he was honest, you know, and he was transparent, and he took on the questions. That's so important. I'm so glad that we're able to do this for you. And I'm so glad that you're there to let us do this for you. Thanks so much for being with us. We're going to share this, of course, on X and on Spotify, and it'll be on BitChute. And believe it or not, people, I don't have a channel on YouTube, but yes, last night my wife and I were looking at YouTube. So people on YouTube are now taking our shows and putting it on the air, and they're getting tens of thousands of views. Has nothing to do with us. People just take it and put it on there because they want people to see it. Whoever you are, thank you. That's nice, I guess. And then there's BitChute. You know, I've joined BitChute because they promise they won't take my stuff down. They will not cancel me. They won't demonetize me. They won't do all of that stuff. So check out BitChute at BitChute.com as well. Hey, thanks for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll look for you next time.